Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
How sad that we fear reaching out to people when we need each other so much. And I think that we've just like learned like a way of being that is just so out of sync with like how humans and how like just other living things on this earth like grow successfully. And by being connected, that's what creates healthy ecosystems.
It is my pleasure to welcome Heather Bird Harris to the podcast today. Heather is an artist and history educator based in Atlanta, Georgia. Through painting and social practice, she engages site-specific materials to explore place and memory, the through lines between history and environmental crises, and mothering in the face of climate change. Heather received her BA in art history from Skidmore College and a master's degree in education leadership from Columbia University. She served as principal of a turnaround school in New Orleans and continues to consult with school leaders across the South to implement anti-racist history education. Her art practice has been featured nationally on NPR, Sea Change, and the All We Can Save project. Heather is exhibited at the New Mexico State University Museum, Art Fields, Stoveworks, and many more, and she was recently announced as one of seven artists selected for the Art and Social Justice Fellowship at Emory University. Heather currently lives in Atlanta with her partner and two children, and she and I have been connected for a couple years now, but I was telling her off script before this that I can't believe she hasn't been on the podcast yet. So Heather, officially welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
It just like, you know, I'm like describing what we're going to do. And I'm like, but you've done this before. And I'm like, no, you haven't. Like, you haven't been on yet. You're just such an artist mother icon to me. And we've had so many good artist mother conversations and, you know, studio visits and stuff that I sometimes forget that you haven't done this yet. So I'm so
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks, Kaylin, for inviting me and then like creating this whole space too.
Of course.
It's a big part of my identity. It resonates with me a lot.
So let's chat about your work and your life as an artist. I want to know if being an artist was something that you always thought you would do. Was art a part of your childhood? Curious to hear a little bit about your background kind of growing up.
Yeah. So like, yes, I always identified as an artist, but I never thought I was going to be that. I was like, oh yeah, I want to be an artist, but I can't do that realistically until I'm retired and I have a pension and I'm 60. Like, these are like actually the thoughts I had as a teenager, you know? I mean, I was always really creative growing up. I like written expression, like I always journaled. I would like do scrapbooks, doodling, a lot of poetry too. Like I remember like getting a lot of praise in elementary school for like drawing like representational things. There was this specific goose when I was like in second grade that got like a lot of buzz.
Like a drawing like, that you made of a goose?
Yeah. It's like, you can draw. And so that just became a part of my identity through, you know,
that buzzy like, goose drawing.
Yeah. And then it was shoes. And then it was like, oh, draw my shoes. And I had a shoe drawing little thing going for a while. Gosh. Then it was like people's faces in high school. So like, yeah, I always identified as like, oh, I'm good at that. So that's the art that I make. And yeah, and that continued. I did go to school for art and art history at Skidmore.
You're from the Northeast, right? So yeah. Skidmore, like, I think you're from Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I was originally from Connecticut and then went to school in Skidmore, upstate New York. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And then,
I know several people who've gone to Skidmore and have had folks on the podcast who've gone to Skidmore, and I'm from New York State too. So just that kind of Northeast connection for sure.
It's a great, creative community, and I had the best time there. When I was doing art there, I was still hanging on to like the representational, like that's always what I thought I was good at. So yeah, I think I've always seen myself as an artist, but and that's why I also probably I majored in art history instead of studio art. It was like, okay, I want to be in the arts, but I need to have a salary job. Mm-hmm. It's just what I thought needed to happen. I just didn't know. I didn't know any working artists. I didn't see that. I didn't think it was an option.
So then you ended up at Columbia for educational leadership. How did that kind of happen?
So I graduated in 2009 into the recession.
Yeah.
My plan was to go to New York or Boston and work in like a museum and, an art adjacent job. And those kind of dried up around like 08, 09. And so then I had a boyfriend in New Orleans. And so I would try to get down to New Orleans. And then Teach for America came to campus and was like, we need people to come to New Orleans. And so it was just kind of like young timing. I was like, great. Yeah. And so I went down to New Orleans and did Teach for America and taught in middle schools, art, English, and social studies. Wow. And then from there went into like admin working in schools in New Orleans, and then became a principal way too young. I was 25. Of a principal in New Orleans East. And then they helped me get my master's at Columbia through that. So amazing. I had a very intense, like an important tangent into education that really, I thought it was very unrelated to art and what I had thought I was going to do. But I also like remember that first year first year of teaching, there's nothing harder. Mm-hmm. And I like wanted to quit every day. And at some point I was like, okay, I'm going to stay, but I need to feel more creative than what I do every day. And I just decided that I needed to approach teaching with creativity. And that really helped me stay and enjoy it.
And I bet it was such a service to your students too, who, probably may not have had as much exposure in their educational backgrounds to the arts. And
I hope so. I tried my best. It's really hard to work within the American public education system and do all the things and be creative. And so, that's what that kind of focus helped me stay. And it also helped me realize in retrospect, now I can see how like some of like my social practice work and like that is more like values based, like actually started then. And it wouldn't necessarily be deemed like a formal artwork, but is very related to, creating learning experiences for people that help shift perspective. And I think at times, like teachers are doing that all the time.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, well, two things. My kids go to an arts magnet school, and I'm even surprised at how tough it is for an arts magnet school to like keep funding and space for the arts because of all of the demands and the standards and the funding having to go to like STEAM and, STEM stuff instead of like music and art and just, it's like a whole thing. But I was just, thinking about your story too, and how, you are such a social practice based artist, and just kind of thinking about like this white girl from Connecticut, like moving to New Orleans and becoming, kind of boots on the ground, like faced with things and communities and, situations and needs that you probably did not experience like growing up, mm-hmm. and how formative that like Teach for America and those years in, you know, public school in New Orleans must have been for you. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, you did allow it to shape your values and, you know, kind of the rest of your life so far moving forward, rather than like kind of running from that experience or getting so overwhelmed and moving out of it. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it. You know, I really had,
I feel like a kinship with you in that I would feel like I had a lot to learn.
so much. Like the learning experience, the learning curve was just insane. And I worked so hard. Like this is all pre-kids, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, in my 20s, yeah, I was working like 80 hour weeks, like minimum. Weekends, like I was always at a coffee shop, you know, just like and just trying to make it work and trying to do the best I could to create a learning space for students and for my team. I led a team of about 30 educators to like what kind of conditions need to exist for people to really, you know, be the best versions of themselves. And there were years that I think we got really, really close to that. And there were years that I think that we slipped away from that. And it all really is so dependent on so many variables outside of the school. Mm-hmm. But it rests on the shoulders of like individuals within the school building to do everything they can, despite all of the barriers and pressures that are put on them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think like our best years and our closest like version to like what I picture like a successful, like what's my ideal school? Like, I think we got really close to that for a time. And it was because of like this just really collaborative, really vision aligned group of awesome people.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, so, I feel like you could be on an education podcast and have so much to say.
It's so related. I think it's so related because, you know, another reason I think I was like, I don't know, I don't want to go into work at a gallery post-college like that. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really interested in that because I was always really put off by art world elitism shit. Mm-hmm. Like, can I swear on the podcast?
Yes.
Okay. It's always been really off-putting to me. I don't feel like I belong there. You know, I grew up really middle class. Like it's just very unfamiliar and I don't like playing those games. So, you know, I entered education as like, as an alternative to going that route. Mm-hmm. And it also by doing that reinforced what I thought, you know, it's like, what are the real experiences of the world that like are, that really matter in people's day to day, you know, safety, education, community, like those things are, you know, it kind of reinforced that. And so now like, as I'm returning to like the art side of, or, you know, the more formal art practice, that I'm carrying that too. And I think that really has shaped, my practice and
that integration really, is so needed.
Yeah. And I like, that's just a continuing, problem solving I'm doing for myself is like, it feels really connected, but like, I want to continue to connect those, like the, between art and education and like history and art and, creating, experiences and artwork that can have that same kind of, like community impact.
That's why I love you, Heather, because you're amazing. Can you describe your art for maybe some of our listeners who've never seen it?
Yeah.
We'll be sharing a lot of it, but, you know, I want to have you kind of talk a little bit about your process and how you got to kind of making the work that you're making now, because you know, you said before you were, your kind of intro was these very like hyper realism, type work, drawing specifically. Yeah. And I don't see much drawing in your practice right now.
No, there's no more goose.
No more goose. No more buzzy geese.
So I guess I'll start with kind of, you know, what it looks like now. I use, I'm interested in how history connects us to our current like environmental crises. Mm-hmm. And to explore that, I use site specific materials, as, you know, living record keepers, storytellers, you know, kind of witnesses of that history and participants in climate change. Mm-hmm. You know, so for example, like earth pigments, so I'll use soil, rocks, natural inks from native and invasive plants, sun as a material. It can also be site specific and time specific, and as well as water. Mm-hmm. And so using those type of materials to explore like behavior, like their behavior, like how do they react with each other? Mm-hmm. How do they flow together? And so my work on like surfaces, like my visual practice on canvas and paper is kind of very like meditative and personal. It's like I view it as like my introspective side of my practice, where mm-hmm. it's really about just seeing and observing and noticing and learning, like mm-hmm. from natural materials in a way that is, I feel like, is bringing me back to a slowness and a connection that can get lost in the capitalist grind. And I have
absolutely
fallen victim to. So it's kind of like feels like going for a walk in the woods or staring at the ocean. It's kind of that thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my more extroverted side of my practice is a social practice work, which similarly, you know, uses those materials and site-specific history and community concerns of like what's the environmental issue that different places and communities are concerned with, to create learning experiences for people to share memories and stories and hopes. Hopefully like a galvanizing moment that can center around some reflection or action.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. I know that, you know, land is so specific to your work and kind of this experience of the earth and water and these materials, the sun, these materials that you've shared. And it just kind of got me thinking about how, you know, different types of people and different types of communities have different experiences with the land. And, mm-hmm. you know, part of that is due to privilege. And I was wondering for you, like, what were some of those experiences, maybe earlier on or even recently, of land that kind of really helped bring that into your art practice? You know, are there specific places that you remember experiencing, not necessarily nature? You know, I think mm-hmm. obviously nature is like a big part of it, but, you know, it could be the damage of land or, yeah. you know, I know, like, for example, New Orleans, like living in New Orleans for so many years, it is this kind of, you know, very charged place when we're talking about climate change and the way that climate change and the land is directly affecting communities, particular, you know, communities in poverty and those who are not getting resources that they really need. So mm-hmm. I was just thinking about you and your work and how maybe there have been these moments of you experiencing the land that really kind of brought you, or that caused you to bring art in direct conversation with this. And if you wanted to talk about some of those specific experiences or places.
Yeah. So in 2017, I switched from being a school leader to doing anti-racist history curriculum. Mm-hmm. My kids had just been born. Jade was just born. And I couldn't foresee how I personally could maintain being a school leader and have kids. So I switched to do that for the same school network. So I was writing history curriculum at the time. And Trump was president. And so there was this beginning of this, you know, battle of facts and what's real and what history, you know, is part of the American conscience. And while actively trying to write it and revise it to be closer to the truth. Mm-hmm. And so that's the context for, like, I was staring at the river, which, you know, if you've ever been in New Orleans, the Mississippi, when it reaches New Orleans, is like an out, right before it goes out to the Gulf, it's like huge and it carries so much sediment. Mm-hmm. And so it's really brown and it's really powerful and it's really, really dirty. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very, very polluted from, mm-hmm. you know, it's carrying all of, like, the farmland runoff from all of America at that mm-hmm. point. And also when it reaches New Orleans has gone through, you know, this area in Louisiana called Cancer Alley, or known as Cancer Alley, which is like 85-mile stretch of petrochemical plants. And so anyway, that exists all along the river. And so I'm looking at the river and thinking about how it got that way and how that history is, like, being denied so blatantly, like, in like denying, like, the evidence of how history, you know, led to that, which mm-hmm. is by, like, through colonial decision making. Mm-hmm. Which is why the levees were built, which is why New Orleans, you know, the flooding of the river couldn't happen annually, which is why there wasn't sediment buildup and why New Orleans is now under sea level mm-hmm. because of, you know, white colonial attempts at controlling the water. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, you know,
for their own capitalist use, not to better the water.
Yeah. I mean, New Orleans has always for millennia been a place of meeting and diversity. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the meeting point for many indigenous nations in Louisiana and all across the Southeast. It was known as Bulbancha. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was with the flow of the river. So mm-hmm. when it would flood in the spring, they would move and then they mm-hmm. would come and gather at times that made sense. And so it was like a European way of, we live here now. These are our fences. These are our boundaries. This is how we control the river, right. You know, and that type of thinking that, you know, leads to flooding and leads to a lot of these natural disasters that disproportionately affect communities of color mm-hmm. in New Orleans. So I'm looking at, you know, I'm just looking at the river and I'm like, you know, need to do this painting for my friend who's also a history writer and activist in New Orleans. And I'm thinking about how, you know, despite all of the political attempts to erase history, that despite that, the land holds that history and remembers. And so it was kind of a way to, I don't know, it's kind of hard to put into words, but I think that's where the art comes in, where it's like that the land can be like a record and is a record of history despite mm-hmm. human attempts to forget for political convenience and grabs at power.
Mm-hmm. And then your art becomes sort of your, you know, a way to capture some of that evidence, a way to express your own feelings of, well, just your own feelings that are very, very mixed, I'm sure, about your experiences of the land. And
yeah. There's that too, where it's like mm-hmm. there. So, you know, I think one other thing is that it's also capturing my learning process. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I arrived to New Orleans as a Northern, you know, white girl, and like, who grew up in a patriarchal, capitalist, white supremacist society. And so mm-hmm. so much unlearning has had to happen and continues to happen. And so you know, I think like one thing that my work is also documenting is that learning process. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I was looking at the river and I was like, I wonder if I can just like use this silt. Like I had no idea how to actually do it with like, mm-hmm. with the process that I would learn later. And so, you know, it's also documenting like the learning process and ways of seeing for myself mm-hmm. that have, you know, thankfully evolved over time and I hope continue to do so.
And then let's get in the nitty gritty about some of the different works that you've made and talk more tangibly about those works
sure.
because
yeah.
I'm thinking in particular of a project that you did after you actually left New Orleans, I believe you had already mm-hmm. moved to Atlanta. And I think last fall, maybe spring, you went back and did this river project specifically with canvas. And, you know, you were kind of interested in the effects of the sediment of the pollution in the river and what it would do to your canvas, which you would then mm-hmm. but I'll let you describe it. Would you talk about that?
Well, it's still just an idea.
Okay.
It's
an amazing idea. Like, I feel like it was like the performance, like it's already said so much just in the, like, you know, just in what you did. So can you describe what you did and where?
So, I guess like as a way of like, you know, trying to understand what's in the water and how it got there and why. A couple artists
and through the lens of an artist, like I think it's important to remember, like you're not a biologist, you're not a scientist, you're not taking beakers of this water and taking it back to there's ways to do that are not art based. But I find interesting is like, the mind of the artist is doing this, you know?
Yeah. It's like, I've become increasingly closer to science, which I have never felt comfortable in. Mm-hmm. I'm in conversation with like many, scientists and that have been that do work in very similar ways, and communicate it so differently. And I think there's a lot of value in that range of communication because it reaches different audiences mm-hmm. around like a very like important topic. But through a bunch of artists got on a boat on the Mississippi in Baton Rouge.
Was this a project that you organized?
It was either me or Hannah Shalhoub we've gone out with. She's an artist in New Orleans and a friend of mine, and we have gone out with Richie on a Delta Discovery Tours is the name of his company, and he is just a really, really wonderful resource for Southern Louisiana. He just knows a lot about the history and the and has seen the environmental shifts and like the changes in water and land with his own eyes and throughout his lifetime. And so he does these tours for anybody, but it mm-hmm. attracts a lot of artists and scientists and scholars who are trying to like just understand what's happening in Southern Louisiana, which is like really at the forefront of mm-hmm. of climate change, unfortunately. So we went with Richie and went down from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, which is an 85 mile stretch of known as Cancer Alley that I mentioned before. And really just wanted to see what it was. You know, we've seen photographs and mm-hmm. I've written so many lessons about it, but it is really inaccessible to people. Like mm-hmm. There's no residencies, there's no like residences, mm-hmm. like there's no houses along that stretch of the river. There's like two right outside of New Orleans, and they're not allowed to pass it to the next generation. So those last two houses are going to be gone after after this generation. But yeah, we were also the only private boat, you know, on the whole day. Mm-hmm. It's really for it's really industrial and for shipping and petrochemical plants. And so I dragged a canvas down that stretch of the river with the idea that like just kind of what I want to see is how if I do the same action to the river canvas and then like a neutral canvas with natural elements of land and water, sun, maybe using like cyanotypes, and how is it going to react, and what's in the canvas that you can't see, or is very not well documented but exists there, like how is it going to look in comparison to what it should look like. So yeah, that's the idea. I haven't done it yet, but my idea is to sew those together. So I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, I can't wait. I just think, like I said, what was interesting to me was just the physical journey that you had to take and sort of the risks that were kind of involved in that and the awareness that that journey brought. And then, you know, to see the effects of something that, you know, people won't drink necessarily. Some people probably do and have to.
No. So right at the end of the journey was like probably the most breathtaking part was at the end of the day, right outside of New Orleans, there's Richie was like, that pipe right there, which we've been seeing pipes all day. He's like, that's the source of the fresh drinking water for all of New Orleans. It's just like, it looks like a black straw. And it's like leaking, and it's like this, a boat had crashed into it, and it's like a year ago, and it's like really decrepit looking. And he's like, yeah, he said, every pot of pasta starts right here. And I was like, how have I been, you know, at that point, I've been living in New Orleans for 13 years. I've been working on like, and you know, in very like water related, doing water related work. And I had never really thought about like, where is our water coming from? And thought about, that's what it is. And New Orleans apparently has like a very, really, really good water filtration system, and they remove a ton of sediment. So anyway, from there, I started talking to some people about what that filtration system is like. And
but that straw, that pipe is after the 85 mile stretch of the cancer chemicals being
and
dumped into
the whole American farm runoff before that. Yeah.
Right. The whole country's ag, big ag that lives along the Mississippi, that there's not regulation. And
yeah. And like, and also that site that we saw is not accessible to people, and that's for a reason. Mm-hmm. And it's like the ways that we are connected to each other and connected to so many environmental decisions and really bad human decisions in the name of capitalism, like that is all hidden on purpose. Mm-hmm. And it was just really, really wild to see. I don't know.
Well, tell me a little bit about your transition to Atlanta and maybe some of, you know, the ways that you're wrestling with these topics in your work now that you're kind of in a different community and, you know, you're seeing different experiences of the land and you've, you know, brought your family into a community where, you know, climate crisis is doing different types of things. And also like that your family, and I don't mean just climate crisis, because I know that you're work is also experienced and largely influenced by like the wonderful things that you enjoy about land and nature. And yeah, if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So we left New Orleans and moved to Atlanta mainly because of Hurricane Ida in 2021. It was just kind of an eye-opening moment for us. And we, that was a decision that made the most sense for our family. We didn't have a reason to move to Atlanta, like in terms of like family or job, but we did, you know, over the year after the storm, we did a national search of like, where might align with our priorities. And yeah, that brought us to Atlanta. I think like, you know, I think my work also shifted after the storm. You know, we were displaced for about a month
came back and then like it was not like everyone was out of routine for like another month, like trash pickup didn't start for like 2 months, like it was and then schools too was also COVID, like we were just a mess. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really stressful even when we were back. And at that point, you know, I remember, my studio flooded. Mm-hmm. And a lot of canvas had molded already. The black mold really spreads fast. Mm-hmm. But I tore off the parts that the black mold hadn't reached yet. And it was just like kind of like some strips at the end. Mm-hmm. But I rolled them up and I just like had these scrolls of like the canvas that was left. Mm-hmm. And I would like just go in the studio and like during this really stressful time and just play, like it was really just, you know, oh, what happens when this color touches this color, and and what does water do to this? And it was just like I really reached a many moments of flow that was like just what I needed to turn my brain off at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was, yeah, and it was like beautiful and it was enjoyable. And then, you know, when I was kind of like done and I was like, okay, I made some work from that. And I'm like writing about it and trying to think of like, what just happened? I like blacked out for like a month or two. Like, what did I just do? And, you know, what it was is, this is also, you know, while we were starting this process of like, do we have to leave? Mm-hmm. And so at the, you know, when I'm like writing about it, I was realizing that, what I was watching and observing and really enjoying was actually looking at how does water move land. Mm-hmm. And it's still kind of confusing to me. Mm-hmm. Like, how could the thing that I almost held it together, Kaylin. how could the thing that like is so scary to me and like was about to uproot my life, how could that thing be also so beautiful?
Mm. Yeah. And that's kind of at a micro scale, what you're doing in the studio, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And like
how water and sediment affect each other.
Yeah. And I really, really enjoy like just visually like what happens. And it's really beautiful how like natural elements work together. And I think that so much, there's so many like human parallels that can be drawn from that of like how we should, you know, be with each other, how we should connect, like how do we make way, you know, there's a lot of like really nice visual parallels. And I think like it makes me think about, you know, like the levees and how like climate change is scarier when you are in a mode of living that is based on colonization. Mm-hmm. It is, and when you're trying to control natural elements to fit a way of living that isn't responsive to the land and isn't respectful stewardship, it's scarier then. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it's almost searching for like a way to, you know, look forward, solutions-based, like, how are we going to survive this? Like, I really think it comes back to like learning about what should I know? You know, I wasn't raised with this kind of understanding, you know, and to no fault of my parents, but mainly because like I grew up in America. And yeah, so
because it's not a part of our education or our narratives.
So I'm just trying to, I think, like through that process, like, yeah, learn about what I should know and what maybe the, you know, indigenous knowledge that has been intentionally, you know, erased that can help us through. And to create, you know, a more respectful and sustainable future. One thing I want to add, and I know I've been rambling, is that I think that in terms of like communicating climate change, that so much of our imagery is usually fear-based, and that there's a lot of power in like natural beauty to communicate similar things. And it's more accessible emotionally for people, I think. because it's, if it's too scary and it's too big, and it, then, you know, we tune out and can't act.
Well, and it also like feels apocalyptic. Like it just feels so overwhelming, and like there's no entry point to seeing yourself in that situation. It's like you just see, like you're just visualizing like a movie, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, that's horrible. I hope it doesn't happen to me. Like, how many times have I thought that, you know?
Yep.
And I think, you know, that, I don't know, by being able to tell stories and learn about like how beautiful this world is, like that, that can really, really help like wake people up, because I think, you know, attention is the prerequisite for care. And we have a lot of caring to do at this point.
Absolutely. Attention is the beginning of devotion. I think that's a Mary Oliver quote. Either Mary Oliver or Anne Lamott. I don't know. It's one that I've like had on a post-it note floating around for years, you know.
You know, wait, I think that was in the stay home residency.
I think it was. Studio. I think you're right. Yeah. I knew I had it on a post-it note somewhere. I'm like, it's not in front of me now, but at some point in my life, I've had that quote.
Yeah, no, I think I remember seeing that. I was like, oh, yep, that's it.
But yeah, that, I mean, I think both in my art practice and my parenting experience, like that has been a quote and a value for me that like where we put our attention, we are showing care, you know, like we are showing love, like we are attention is the beginning of devotion, you know. This episode is sponsored by the Thrive Together Network. TTN is a virtual community I run for women artists. We have a space right on the network for artist caregivers to connect, and it is truly my favorite place on the internet. Every Tuesday, I co-host a session called Art and Tea, where our community comes together to connect as artists. We share our goals and provide accountability for each other and talk about lots of topics artists deal with, ranging from how to put on an exhibition, organization tips for your studio, ways to manage stress, and so much more. The Thrive Together Network is an inclusive platform for artists, and so much is included in your membership. It's crazy. We offer 2 virtual art residencies a year to help you stay on track with your studio goals. We have an exhibition program called Taking Up Space, those Tuesday art and tea sessions that I mentioned. We have monthly workshops on art business, art writing. We even have a book club. Plus, there's hundreds of artists to connect with from all over the world. Because of the Artist Mother partnership with TTN, we have a discount code for you just for artist caregivers to join the network. You can take $10 off your monthly membership fee for the Thrive Together Network, but your best deal is actually if you sign up for a year with us, commit to a whole year of joining us and joining our programming, and you'll save over $140 on your membership. So head to www.artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more and check it out. Membership comes with a free 2-week trial too, so you can truly get in there and see what you think before you actually commit to becoming a member. Just a reminder, on the network, we have a special group for artist caregivers where we have intentional conversations about our roles and identity as artists who are making work and balancing all of the caregiving that we do. We even have quarterly meetups for this group for deeper times of connections. I would really love to get to know you on the network, see more about your work and your art practice, and just connect with you in this amazing, compassionate, intentional, and encouraging community of female artists. We are all about providing resources to help you grow your art career, and this effort is combined with tools and the means to connect with the artists who are on a similar path, who are doing similar things with their careers. So once again, you can head to artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more, to get our discount code, and to join the Thrive Together Network. kind of an underlying theme of what you've shared, Heather, is the idea of community and connection. And you have really shown me some tangible examples of how to be a community builder and a connector just as an individual artist. Like, you know, many times I think of sort of big picture ways to do that. Mm. Like, how can I offer something that a lot of people can have access yeah. to? Like, for example, this podcast. Mm-hmm. But I'm not always as good, you know, when it comes to like my own individual art career and like, hey, like the one-on-one, like, I want to invite you to this show or like, you know, kind of those types of things. And I feel like you have kind of been an inspiration for me. You know, there's been times where you've said, I just want to introduce you to this person over email or, and with no expectation other than like, you would be a great connection or, you know, this is somebody you should know, like those mm-hmm. types of things. So I feel like grateful to you that you've shown me, you know, how community building and connection can look at a different sort of scale mm-hmm. in your life as an artist. And I think it's very inspirational. And, you know, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how, you know, you think of community building and connections as an artist. You know, I think sometimes artists feel like when we express our needs or we reach out to somebody or we even sometimes when we offer somebody something, there's that influence of capitalism is very much a part of that. And we feel like we're doing something wrong. We feel shame, you know, we feel, you know, it's very vulnerable to kind of build community in a way, like it feels like you're sticking your neck out there, you know, and I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that because I can see the growth that you've done in your own life to like be able to do that without that shame.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't, well, I think it's related to a lot of the things we've talked about is that like, yeah, I think that like how sad that we fear reaching out to people when we need each other so much. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've just like learned like a way of being that is just so out of sync with like how humans and how like just other living things on this earth like grow successfully, mm-hmm. you know, like I think about like, you know, do you know how like the internet, have you ever seen like a map of the internet? There's like this like visualization of what the internet looks like. And it looks like, you know, a fungal network, like it looks like mm-hmm. mycelium. Yeah. And it looks like what the universe.
Like the commercials like. Of the AT&T or Verizon, where it's like the lights like kind of pop up all sure. over the country. Yeah. Like,
yeah. And like the internet is like that human connection, but it's not the internet, it's humans, right? It's like, that's human communication. And like, and by being connected, that's what creates healthy ecosystems. Like, so I don't know, that's kind of what I think about conceptually. And then like, I also think that people are just people and that kind of like, yeah, like I guess the fear around like, oh, like networking is icky and like mm-hmm. that I don't want to like use people and I don't want to be used, like totally, me either. That is gross. Mm-hmm. If you are doing it with the intention of use and not relationship, you mm-hmm. know, like if you, I just think that so many people have so many beautiful ideas and that those ideas need to be like watered mm-hmm. and like
nourished,
tended. Yeah. And mm-hmm. that how do you do that? It's like by connecting people who have similar ideas so that they can bounce off of each other and grow. So, I don't know. And then I also think that like, I think about the political system and how like, connections between people are centered around healthy ideas are like the seeds of revolution and that, mm-hmm. there are just, there's more of us than them. Mm-hmm. And like, if we can find connection in that, then like, that's what creates healthy communities, I think. And it's not just artists, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's everybody. So we just did this land memory project in Atlanta, and there was this moment where, so it brought a group of people together that, you know, were concerned about, wanted to learn about history, mm-hmm. or were concerned about the environment. There's a soil scientist, Ari Sakaiwa, who studies soil health in Atlanta. And there's a historian, Lauren Michael Mortimer, who was there. He's a Native American history professor. And Ari was sharing about how, you know, the history of like slag in Atlanta soil, which is lead heavy metal used for like railroad fill and construction fill. And she was talking about soil remediation, which is like, how can you fix it? How can you make it better? And she said that, you know, they've experimented and found really positive traction with sunflowers and cowpeas. And Lauren was like, had this like aha moment. He was like, those are native Muskogee plants. And like, so that connection wouldn't have happened if we weren't in the same room talking about those ideas and like bringing people together. It's like, I think your work might intersect. Mm-hmm. And that has launched a potential project that we're working on in this fall. And I just think there's so many moments like that and the possibility of that, especially, you know, bringing in non-artists to the conversation and if you have a good idea, you got to talk to other people about that idea because other people have it too.
Well, and speaking of, I just wanted to briefly plug that you're a mentor again for our Crit Crew program through Thrive Together Network. And, you know, this is a 9-week mentorship program that we offer that's really about getting feedback on your work. And one of the things that, you know, I think we've done this program like 9 or 10 times now. And one of the things that we've from the beginning emphasized is, you know, both affordability and accessibility for artists who particularly are caregivers or who don't have a lot of time. So like that virtual component of building community and having access to each other in ways that are convenient, you know, to artists who have a lot on their plate. But another principle that we've always emphasized in this program is like this idea of supportive feedback rather than feedback that is meant to sort of break down your ideas. Like our feedback is very catered around nourishing your ideas and feeling growth in a way that is not condescending or, you know, not sort of rooted in criticism, but rooted in care.
And that's just what all education should be. That's what all learning should be. So it's like, unfortunately, like that stands out as special, but like, that's just how people learn in the most effective way.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that has been one of, you know, the driving force for starting that program was, you know, coming from art school and knowing that so many artists really fear critique because there is sort of this expectation, particularly in higher education art programs, that, you know, the professors, like the way that you grow as an artist is to in grad school is to like be stripped down, you know, to be broken down, you have to rot, like, and it's just like, that is so old school garbage that, you know, is so much rooted in patriarchy. And, I feel so passionate about this program because I think, you know, it is a way to invite change in those conversations around your work. And I think female identifying artists, especially, it can just be very intimidating to invite feedback, invite conversation around your work, because you already feel sort of so on the outside, you know, that that idea of acceptance and of progress and sort of motivation for your art is not always something that comes natural to us because of the culture that we live in. Do you want to just share who your visiting artist is going to be for this program this time and a little bit about Jessica?
Yeah. Okay. I'm so excited because Jessica Caldas is like an Atlanta powerhouse of an artist, and she is amazing. Her work is so good. She does a lot of sculpture and performance around community caretaking, actually. A lot of people think her work is like just about motherhood and that experience, but it's so much more about that. It's really about, so she does these like wonderful works called Tired Bodies that are like massive like stuffed fabric that just like kind of hang and have really long arms and long legs, and they just look like tired bodies in a way that really, really resonates. And but that tired bodies also like in community with each other. And so she arranges them and like really like joyfully and like decorates them with like, you know, I don't know. I could go on and on. But she is very, very smart. And I'm so excited to have her as our visiting artist to offer, community caretaking, in a different way to people for Crit Crew. It's such a great thing, and there should just be so much more of it. I'm really excited to be a part of it.
So if you're interested in working with Heather and Jessica this fall, enrollment will open September 5th for this program. You can go to thrivetogethernetwork.com and book your spots. There's 4 spots to be in a small group with Heather and Jessica, and, you know, meet with them for 9 weeks. The actual program start is the week of October 9th, and it'll run for 9 weeks, kind of before the holiday season, it'll wrap up. So as I mentioned before, it is a small group mentorship program where you're getting gentle but intentional feedback on your work. And we try to keep it affordable. It's $395, which for a 9-week program, is a great value, I think. And getting the chance to work one-on-one with you and with Jessica is just kind of priceless. So thank you for being a part of that program, Heather. I'm going to ask you a few more questions before we wrap up this interview, but I wanted you to talk a little bit more, because this is the Artist Mother podcast, just about your experience as a parent and how, motherhood intersects with your art practice. We've talked a lot about how your social concerns and, you know, your experience of the injustice around climate change and disproportionate communities affects your practice. But what about just on a day-to-day level of having 2 little kids in your house? Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah.
How old are your kids?
So Jade is 6 and Hazel is 4. I've changed locations a bunch of the studio, but right now it's in my house on the first floor, which is great because I can go in and out and just, you know, late night and don't have to commute. So that's made it very possible. And I'm glad you brought it back to this, because I realized I never answered that question about why I'm not still drawing geese. And it has to do a lot with motherhood, because in terms of like how motherhood changed my work, is that like I didn't have an active practice between the stretch of college and motherhood. Like motherhood brought me back to it. I maybe painted 2 paintings within like a decade, like between that. And obviously motherhood shifts priorities. And for me, it was like, I don't want to wait until I'm retired. I think that this is a really big part of my identity that I'm like withholding from myself, and I don't want to lose myself in this experience because it became very clear how possible that was. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I was just trying to be like the best version of myself.
Mm. Amazing.
And so, but it did mean that, like, especially in those young years where it's like, I, you know, with the kids when they're, it was trying to do art in, during nap time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just time becomes so precious because you have so little of it. And mm-hmm. so I just felt myself like, you know, so when I started again, I was starting with drawing and I was doing, you know, representational work and in short little bits. And I had this realization that I was like, this is stressing me out more than it's helping. You know, this is not making me a better mom. I feel like I'm, you know, when I fail at representing something accurately, it's like, oh, I don't know. I would just go back more frustrated. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I just need to loosen up and I need to, like, the goal of this time needs to be that I need to feel better. Mm-hmm. And so I think through that realization, I was able to become a little bit more truer to myself and not just focused on having a practice like centered around the praise I had gotten in the past.
Right.
And like what feels good. And for me, that was really like not trying to replicate reality and letting go of control and really like exploring and learning. And that's what felt better for my brain. Mm-hmm. And so I started with like abstracted landscapes of Southern Louisiana. And then it just became like fully abstract and much more materials based. And so that, yeah, motherhood completely changed that for me.
Amazing. All right. Well, tell me what you've got going on kind of in the near future. What are some goals that you're working on within your art practice, within your family life? Anything you want to share?
Yeah. So I am doing, I'm going back to school on Monday. Oh my goodness. I decided I'm going to go get my MFA. I'm in a place where I just want to grow and learn so much. Mm-hmm. And had the opportunity to go to Georgia State, which is in Atlanta, 20 minutes from my house, and it's fully funded. So this is the only way I was ever going to do more education mm-hmm. for myself, was to not pay for it and not move. And so this is just like another artist mother, Sarah Irvin. I was like, should I go? Yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't want to be overwhelmed. And she was like, you just won the lottery with this.
Yes.
Like, you have to go. And so I was like, okay. And so that was a big part of it too. It's like, yeah, that's happening. I'm very, very excited. It's a 3-year program and I'm excited to learn and grow. Let my work evolve and be surprised. So I'm excited about that. And I'm also doing a fellowship with Emory University this fall, and which has also started and then starts with students next week as well.
Emory's in Atlanta?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. And
sorry, you're doing a teaching fellowship?
Yeah. So it's the Art and Social Justice Fellowship, which is a really wonderful program. And they partner academics with artists, visual artists, theater, musical, social practice, and they to reimagine a course syllabus and to co-teach that with the goal of infusing art and social justice into the learning of the course.
Teaching for their undergrad students?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, I am, but there's 6 other artists doing it too, and some other ones are graduate or medical school even, you know. It's just, I think, yeah, like just bringing these ideas together from very different perspectives, and there's just so much power in that. So I'll be actually working with Lauren Michael Mortimer, a history professor for Intro to Native American History, and, you know, my job is to help infuse the course syllabus with arts integration, focusing on like rhizomatic learning, which is like you know, really learner focused, not goal oriented, open ended in the way that like rhizomes kind of travel through the soil, like creating the conditions for learning and individual exploration that kind of serves the needs of each rhizome or student. And the question we're focused around is, you know, how can the landscape serve as a, how is the landscape a living record of history? And so we'll be looking at the land around Emory's campus, around Atlanta, also around the Beltline in Atlanta, for how can we read history? How is it present all around us? Yeah.
Wow. Just the power of these two programs and how much they're going to grow and influence your work, and also how perfect you are for, you know, integrating your knowledge and your, you know, activism within these programs. It's just amazing to like see you in this like perfect moment and perfect situation for your career. Really proud of you.
Let's hope I don't fuck it up, Kaylin.
I will tell you that where you are today, which by the time this podcast is out, you know, you'll listen back and be like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I'm in a routine now. And but just that like stress of like right before a new routine begins.
Yeah.
This is where I was last week. Like I was like, my kid, you know, just figuring out when my kids are going to school and like, what is our new routine? And like, when am I working? And just, it was like all last week I was like, everything was making me cry. Like just everything felt so stressful. And now that I'm a week in, I'm like, okay, I can do this. This feels good. I feel happy and healthy. So like,
I feel so seen. Thank you. That's exactly where I'm at. I'm looking forward to structure. You know, that's another big benefit. Like, and within, I'm going to do drop off. I might get to the pool, like to swim some laps. Like I'm going to, I'm feeling really idealistic. So we'll see what happens, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, friend. Well, we always close with five final questions so that our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. Sure. I want to know, who's your biggest art crush?
I have so many.
Of the moment. So
I couldn't pick one. We're going for polyamory here. Anne Hamilton, obviously. Helen Frankenthaler, obviously. Mm-hmm. George O'Keefe. Also, Rick Lowe, huge art crush. And then my friend Renee Royal, who's an artist based in New Orleans, but is also just starting grad school. And her work is so inspirational and beautiful. Check her out. Renee Royal. It's R-O-Y-A-L-E.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. What's one of your favorite places to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
Our family would love to go to Japan. Jade is specifically obsessed with sushi and has been requesting Japan, but I've also wanted to go there forever. I'd also love to like play with like Japanese inks and paper and kind of like explore all of that. So
that is definitely the most common answer to this question. I think our artist mother Japan retreat needs to happen.
Yeah.
Me and you, let's plan it. We have nothing else to do, you know.
Not overcommitted.
Yes. Tell me a film or a book that has been a great inspiration to you.
If you have not read Braiding Sweetgrass, I just need everybody listening to do that. Robin Wall Kimmerer is just a gift to the earth. In so many ways, it really helped change my perspective of, you know, a relationality to, nature and earth and storytelling and like the power of like individual perspective. So, like kind of bringing two worlds together, and she brings Western science and indigenous, wisdom together in such a beautiful way.
Yes. Such a good book. I need to reread that. Favorite meal.
Sushi.
All right. Who do you want to give a shout out to for supporting you and your work?
So many people, I'm actually like, yeah, I have so many letters to write. This is like my gratitude week coming up. It's just like, I have so many people I need to thank. But you know,
top
Josh,
of the list.
Obviously top of the list. Josh, my husband, is so wonderful. And none of this would be possible without him. You know, like, it really takes such strong partnership to be able to help each of us grow individually.
Absolutely. All right. Well, where can folks find you? Tell me your Instagram handle, website. Where are you kind of communicating with people other than booking a spot with Heather to join her crew?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Heather Bird Harris. And my website is heatherbirdharris.com. And also, I'm in Atlanta. And so if you're around and you're listening and you're wondering if you should reach out to this crying, like, very emotional lady right now, like, please do. I'm not always like this.
One of the things I love most about you is your, you know, your sensitivity. So,
yeah, I mean, we're artists, you know, it's part of the thing. But also, yeah, I'm in Atlanta and often in New Orleans. And yeah, I would love to meet people IRL also.
I think we've cried every time we've talked.
Well, yeah, Kaylin, you're a really special person.
So. I really know how to make you cry, Heather. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast, for sharing. Please, everyone, go check out Heather's work. I know this conversation was just going to be, is going to be, very nourishing and inspirational for everyone who listens. So thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Kaylin. Thank you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.